This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm talking with Lisa DePasquale, whose latest book is The Social Justice Warrior Handbook, a practical survival guide for snowflakes, millennials, and Generation Z. Lisa, thanks for talking with Reason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I also want to point out up front that I'm in the acknowledgement sections of section of this book for helping to inspire you. And so are other people ranging from Ann Coulter to Greg Gutfeld to Kat Timpf to God, who I think is really slumming. I think it's fair to say that. But this is a very funny book. I was reading it, and it's like a preppy handbook, but for people who want to become social justice warriors, it's a pretty funny satire. What prompted you to write this book now and in that format?
Well, for me, I didn't want to write anything that was snowflake this and snowflake that, just because that's not my personality, and I don't think the book comes off as mean-spirited, which, you know, I'm certainly not. And you're right to bring up the preppy handbook, because if you remember that from the 80s, it was something that made fun of preppies, but they also sort of embraced it because they're just like, yeah, you know what, that is kind of us. And that's what inspired me to write this book. And I think you'll also see that there's a lot of things that the social justice warriors do. They, you know, sort of have a timeline that they go about doing things. And it's not just people on the left. I mean, there are people on the right that, you know, tend to have some of the same behavior, you know, particularly in an outrage culture.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so talk a little bit about that in terms of how do you define social justice warrior? Because it's partly it's the actions, but it's also the content of the thought behind those actions. But as you were saying, we're in an outrage culture. So what is a, you know, how do you define social justice warrior? And then how do you see the extremes of kind of versions of that on both the right and the left?
Sure. Well, to me, social justice sort of came out of the fact that, you know, they're standing up for gays, transgender, women, people of different races. And now it's sort of devolved into just being outraged at little things, because for the most part, we do have equality. You know, in the United States, where their really problems are outside of the United States, but they want to confine it to the U.S. And part of that is because of the outrage culture, and we've created, you know, media, jobs, and just becoming famous from being able to identify something that you're outraged about. And so when you monetize that, you know, I think it was Gavin McGinnis that said it, you know, when you monetize it, you can find it under a rock. And that's what we're seeing now, I think, from both the left and the right. Everybody knows the left examples, you know, when it comes to, like, this ad has been on Breitbart or that. But on the right, one of the things that disappoints me is seeing so many of, you know, my fellow conservatives or libertarians that buy into that. And, you know, they go to events where there'll be a protest and, you know, maybe someone, you know, clocks them, and they use a video of that to sort of elevate themselves beyond, you know, actually contributing something, you know, to ideas or, you know, to a political philosophy. And it's disappointing to see, because people that I've always looked up to, people like Ann Coulter, I don't think she's ever done that. I mean, you don't see her retweeting the haters, and that's something I think a lot of people on the right now fall back on.
Well, let's get to that in a second, but why don't you describe your politics a little bit more, because you're friends with Ann Coulter, and you've done a lot with her over the years in terms of bringing her to CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee conference annually, which you used to organize before you had a falling out over participation by gay conservative groups. You were in favor of bringing in conservative gay groups. CPAC was not. So you're not exactly a typical conservative, but you are. You identify as a conservative. How to describe your politics and, you know, like where did they come from?
I guess you could call me politically fluid, you know?
Okay, very good, yeah.
Sometimes I'm a conservative, sometimes I'm a libertarian. You know, when I was at CPAC, you know, for me, you know, I always invited you to speak, I think, whenever I could. We had people like Tom Woods and, you know, Ann Coulter, and even the gay groups. And for me, CPAC, and this is one of the things that I give David Keene, who founded ACU and CPAC, credit for, is that he looked at CPAC as a time for everybody on that spectrum to come together and fight. You know, similar to the joke about libertarians, you get more than two libertarians in a room, you know, they're going to have a disagreement. And that's, you know, how CPAC was. I mean, we had Sam Donaldson, and we had, you know, people that were willing to debate on the left, Arlen Specter and those types. And toward 2011, 2010, there were some people on the CPAC board that wanted to control the movement or control the event a little bit more. And that's when I started, I think, getting a bullseye on me, because I wanted it to continue to be that haven for everyone to come together. And that's when I really started looking inward in that, you know, what does it mean to be a conservative versus to being a libertarian? And for me, the social issues was really where it differed for me. And at the time, I actually wasn't a Christian. So I probably was really more on the libertarian side.
So what do you mean? So when you say, so the dividing line for you, between a conservative and a libertarian, has to do mostly with social issues then? I mean, is that being like, pro-life? Is it being against gay marriage or what, or pot legalization?
Yeah, I mean, I guess probably social issues isn't the right way to say it. I guess in the terms of CPAC, it was more on, gay marriage and just acceptance of gays, particularly into the movement. On the economic issues, I mean, it did become clear, and I'm not smart enough to have realized it at the time, but, you know, looking back after attending, you know, five or six CPACs and then running five or six CPACs, you know, here's supposed to be, you know, an event that was, you know, the conscious, you know, of the right. And every year we're having the same speakers, you know, talking about lowering taxes and getting rid of federal regulations and that sort of thing, and nothing changes. You know, even these same people, you know, don't actually do anything beyond, you know, platitudes and sending out fundraising letters.
Oh, so in a way, they're kind of like social justice warriors, right, where it's more about being seen, being outraged, and making the right talk. You know, thinking about the issues about equal rights for gays or marriage equality between conservatives and libertarians, it reminds me of when the National Review had its 50th anniversary dinner, and this would have been in 2005. It was in this giant building. I don't know if you were there in D.C., but it was funny because I noticed the reason table. They did invite us, which was nice. Libertarians were in the room, but we were about 15 rows behind the Log Cabin Republicans, which at that time was the premier kind of gay rights group for conservatives. And I was like, okay, that's about right. That, you know, conservatives are more comfortable with gays who are against gay marriage than they are with libertarians who might be straight but are in favor of gay marriage. So what are the social justice warriors that bug you the most on the left? And then maybe we can talk a little bit about the right. In the book, and this is a sense, I was laughing out loud reading the book, and you talk about feminists broadly. Pardon the pun, it's unintentional, but you mentioned when you're saying, like, okay, if you want to be a feminist, don't just act, overreact, as in ovary and overreacting, which I think is pretty funny. And then you talk about how feminists, that you can get upset at people for treating women like sexual objects and ignoring them as sexual objects, which brought to mind a kind of famous Lena Dunham flap, where she was in a room with Odell Beckham Jr., the football player, and she, in an interview, talked about how, like, he clearly didn't see her in sexual terms because she wasn't his type of, you know, hot-bodied whatever. And it caused a problem, and it kind of illustrated the point. But, you know, are there specific social justice warriors, like individuals that just get under your skin on the left, and who are they, or what is the general type that just, you know, that really inspired you to write this?
Well, I think bringing up Lena Dunham, she's definitely, you know, high on the list, particularly, you know, for that story. And probably for me, feminist, just, you know, being a woman and being like on the outside, everything that, you know, they think is good. I mean, I'm 40, I'm childless. I have had a pretty good career. You know, I'm not a standard body type. So there's all these things that, you know, they claim to be like the pinnacle of success for women. But there's no way they would ever, you know, promote me or, as you know, one of the hashtags going around on Twitter was Amplify Women. They were trying to promote Hillary Clinton's book. And Lena Dunham in particular, because, you know, she's someone that, you know, grew up, you know, a very privileged life, but is continually, you know, wanting to make herself the victim. And it's sort of like slumming it, like politically slumming it. And that's, it really bothers me because it is going back into that victimhood mindset. And if you truly want to empower women, the last thing you should do is tell them that no matter what you do, you're always going to be a victim of the patriarchy or the victim of, you know, Hollywood not giving you enough money or not being, you know, as pretty as a model and that sort of thing.
So, you know, let me ask you with Dunham. Did you watch Girls, which concluded its, I guess it was 5 or 6 season run or however many it was? I watched the show. I read Dunham's book, which I thought was terrible because it was kind of unfocused and kind of thrown together. And the depth of her thought when she's writing about serious issues is just not interesting. She doesn't know that much and doesn't seem to mind that she's kind of incoherent or ignorant on a lot of topics she wants to discourse on. But Girls, by the same token, I thought it was, I found it to be absolutely riveting, and it was such a damning portrait of millennials. Everybody in the show was self- and what do you do with something like that where she seems to be as an artist in that show? I mean, she was painting a kind of nightmare image of her generation and of her people. And yet she doesn't have that critical distance when she's off set or off camera.
I actually really like the show Girls. I didn't see the last season, but, you know, watching it from the beginning, I think you're right in that it was really holding up a mirror toward that millennial generation, and the things that they wanted to say are so empowering, like, you know, sleeping around or not really having a job. I mean, you could see these characters are miserable in that life that they claim is so empowering. And, you know, to me it was more of holding up a mirror to their generation than actually, you know, trying to be empowering. And I don't know how much Judd Apatow had to do with the writing, if that was why it was so different from the book, or if the book was just, you know, stream of thought, let's get a book out so we can have a bestseller. But to me, it reminded me a lot of Sex and the City in that, you know, Sex and the City tried to do the same thing in that, you know, let's show these women, you know, sleeping around like men and doing this and that and all the things that drive conservatives crazy. But then at the end of the show, everyone got their happy ending, and everyone was happy about it. So it sort of ended in a traditionally, you know, conservative family values, you know, type of way, even if the journey was a little different than what people would want.
I was, by the time Sex and the City was done, I was really hoping that, you know, it would, the last episode, they would all be wiped out at 9/11 or something like that. For, you know, God forgive me. And I'm on the same page as God, literally, in your book. So I think I have a special in now. You talk about other things, like the concept of the color millennial pink. And you talk about how it's not pink on steroids, which was a Gen X thing. Everything in Gen X was taken to the extreme. I mean, it was like, you know, Mountain Dew Code Black and stuff, and, you know, the X Games. Millennial pink, you write, is pink on pot. It's mellow, dusty, faded, and co-opted as our own. Best of all, it's suitable for all 63 genders. You know, is that, I guess to go back to, you mentioned Gavin McInnes, the co-founder of Vice, who's also had drifted into a kind of alt-right type of perspective or positions on things. And he now is the head of a group called the Proud Boys, who are unrepentant in their defense of Western culture, as they define it, and all of that. But, you talked about monetizing things. Is that what's driving so much of this? And it's not monetizing in that, yeah, you know, you can sell pussy hats at the Women's March on Washington, but that you can get a place, you can get a microphone somewhere. But, what is going on? Like, why is social justice warriordom becoming such a big thing right now?
You know, I think part of it is just, I mean, probably going back to the Andy Warhol 15 minutes of fame, in that with, you know, social media, you know, here's this tool where everybody can be famous. I mean, you see people on Instagram, you know, just posting, you know, photos of their daily life, and you see instances of someone being offended by, you know, a man being in a movie theater for Wonder Woman.
or a woman's bathroom. Right? From the right.
Correct.
That was...
And actually from the right, a man insisting that he, you know, go to a woman's, or go to a theater to watch, you know, what's supposed to be a fun woman's only showing. I mean, I like the guy that did it personally, but, I mean, it was clearly, you know, a stunt. And so I'm kind of annoyed by all this stunt-driven politics, and the social justice warriors certainly represents that. And, you know, conservatives are getting involved in that way, when I'd rather see, you know, conservatives get involved on, you know, free speech issues and not, you know, get into the boycotts, into the fire this person for saying that. But that seems to be what they're learning from the social justice warriors. And part of it is because the social justice warriors have been so successful in using those tools.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, particularly on, well, when it comes to millennials, you know, when you bring up the millennial pink and all of that stuff, you know, a lot of it is that I don't think have their own identity yet. And so they're going back to, you know, that protest boomers culture where it's like, well, we need to feel like our generation has a thing. And, you know, making the world a better place and, you know, less racist and less sexist and more accepting. I think they're trying to make that their thing. It's just that those problems aren't as big as they've been told they are.
Well, and that's a huge irony, right, for all of this, which is that, and you mentioned this earlier, by virtually any measure, we're far from perfect, but we're so much less racist, sexist, homophobic, you know, whatever you want to say. Like, America is such a much more tolerant and accepting society. What, you know, is it just, and, you know, this is something conservatives say, libertarians say, I think even a lot of liberals say that, you know, millennials have grown up, you know, as these gentle snowflakes that have to be, you know, kept from all sorts of bad news or callous producing work. Do you think millennials are a breed apart, that they, you know, and this is, I guess, a kind of ongoing complaint that the generation after you or two generations after you is always, you know, soft and weak and privileged and entitled. But is there something different about millennials that reflects poorly perhaps on the people who raise them?
Most of them were raised by boomers, but I guess you could probably say the same about Generation X. You know, I don't know if it has to do with, you know, there's such an insulated generation in that because of technology and social media, there is so much focus on them. And then aside from that, I think being separated from, you know, any real troubles, you know, they haven't really seen some, you know, big, you know, fight, like whether it's the Cold War or civil rights in the 60s, right.
Or World War II, certainly. But,
yeah.
But by the same token, have they been knocked into shelter by, you know, when you think about it, the major kind of event for the millennial generation, which are people born between generally 1981 to 2000, and then Gen Z is the 2000 and on. But you know, is 9/11, two wars that are still essentially going on in Afghanistan and the Middle East and Iraq, a terrible economy. I mean, the entire 21st century has seen subpar economic growth, the housing collapse. I mean, perhaps, you know, they're, you know, and it's a weird paradox too, right? Because life keeps getting better. I mean, like our phones get better and better, TV, streaming, you know, medical interventions all get better, but it is also kind of a dismal time, it seems.
Yeah, and I think part of it is they are removed from the war. I mean, there hasn't been, you know, there hasn't been any sacrifice, you know, on behalf of their generation, unlike a generation that went through a war, like World War II generation or boomers with Vietnam. There hasn't been really any sacrifice. I mean, most of them don't know someone, you know, that has died in Iraq or Afghanistan or any of the other dozens of countries we're in. so I think on that side, there probably hasn't been sacrifice. And then on the fact that the job market and the economy isn't doing as well, there hasn't been as much sacrifice because a lot of it, I think, is probably still subsidized by their parents. I mean, there are people in their 30s, you know, that are still on their parents' cell phone plans.
And that's
then
disgusting.
Certainly up to at least...
What would Pardon? The founders say? What would the founders say?
No.
You know, they had a, you know, you got off of your, the parcel post plan, family plan, you know, that Ben Franklin pioneered, but by the time you were 20, if you lived to be 20, you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, and I think it's those types of adult markers that kids are just not, or even, you know, young adults, they're putting off more and more. I mean, whether it's buying a house or getting off your parents' cell phone plan, those milestones are put back farther and farther.
Hmm. But, and, you know, just to stick up for that, and I say this as somebody, I was born in 63, so I'm a late baby boomer, and I always want to blame the baby boomers for everything, and also the greatest generation because they raised the boomers. But, you know, like my parents were born in the 20s, and they started working for real in their teens. I was, you know, going off to college when I was 17 or 18. And I didn't really start a career job until I was 30. So, you know, maybe it's a sign of wealth that we can afford these extended childhoods now. You know, it may not be all bad. But having said that, you know, are conservatives here, you know, well, first off, give me a sense of Donald Trump. Like, what is your sense of Donald Trump? In a way, he has given aid and comfort to social justice warriors. He's given them a reason for being. You know, he's the embodiment of virtually everything they're fighting for. But, you know, and is that true? And then what about the attacks on him from a lot of conservatives? You know, grabbing women by the pussy is not conservative dogma. You know, does he make you uncomfortable, or do you think overall his presence is actually kind of deconstructing the whole social justice warrior paradigm?
Yeah, well, I mean, my last CPAC 2011, he was a surprise speaker at the invitation of Go Proud, the gay conservative group that was, you know, later banned. And, you know, when I introduced them, they had asked me to put in a line about, and if he decides to run, you know, I think he can win. And at the time I thought, you know, sure, why not? And
because
like,
it couldn't possibly come true, right? Like, that's insanity.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is like, I, you know, I did vote for him, but whenever it, you know, he accepted the nomination, I was like sitting in my chair alone in my house laughing. Like, I couldn't believe this actually had happened. And, you know, I think anyone that tries to, you know, say, you know, Trump is a conservative because of this or that, I mean, it's hard to pin him down on any one issue. And that's, I think, largely because he's had a career outside of politics. I mean, most people are not very, you know, like me, they're very fluid when it comes to, you know, their political beliefs. But also most people don't get to be in charge of government. So for me, I think ultimately he's good for politics. And this is something, you know, that I've written before, that I think particularly for libertarians, I think he's good because, you know, he's totally busted up the two-party system. I mean, he used the Republican Party, you know, as a vehicle, but, you know, certainly isn't aligned with them on lots of things. You know, there's been some good things that he's done. There's been some good things that conservatives, you know, don't like. But I don't think liberals are ever going to give him credit. You know, he could want to, you know, I'm trying to think like what he could make, you know, abortion on demand up until, you know, birth tax subsidized. And, you know, liberals will never, you know, give him credit just because they work better, I think, when they have a common enemy. And right now, Trump is, like you said, their perfect enemy. I mean, it's a rich guy, a rich white guy who, you know, marries models, you know, has beautiful children. So there's like that nepotism angle. You know, he's perfect.
So are conservatives kind of just boring old trolls at this point, though? You know, I mean, because, and we talked about this a little bit, you know, the world is becoming more mixed and more mongrelized. It's, you know, partly because of technology, including things like, you know, airfares are relatively cheap. I think more people have passports, you know, than they used to. And you just see a lot of different things. You know, pot is being legalized everywhere. The country is getting more secular, you know, by you. Kind of becoming an active Christian, you know, you're kind of bucking the trend, really. You know, so even if, you know, by all accounts, millennials are much, much more liberal and much, much more democratic, vote for democratic candidates than previous generations, although they are less partisan than older generations in many ways. But, you know, is there a future for conservatives, because it seems as if they, you know, among younger generations, they're kind of dying out.
I think there is, if they start to embrace, you know, ideas, particularly the ones associated with, you know, giving power to people and to, you know, unchaining businesses, and particularly, you know, on the local level. I think that we've probably become too personality driven. And maybe I say that as someone who, you know, isn't a famous personality.
Right. Or someone who lacks any personality whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, what is someone like
I hear
supposed
you.
To do?
I hear you, sister. Yeah.
So, you know, I'd like to see that. The problem is that, you know, people like Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity and Tommy Lahren and, you know, those types, I mean, they sell books or get eyeballs or get retweets or whatever, because they are to the extreme, I think, in their language. Not that I think they necessarily have extreme views, but I think are more extreme just in their language and mean-spirited.
Are they kind of the right-wing social justice warriors that, you know, that you kind of are like, you're rolling your eyes at, or you're saying, come on already? I mean, Sean,
think Hannity, but I think with the younger people, the ones that are more stunt driven, you know, that go to events to try and disrupt them, you know, like the Shakespeare in the Park or those, or, you know, want to say, well, how dare you call me a white supremacist, I'm a Jew or I'm an Asian or this, and they use that to sort of bolster, you know, their cred. You know, I'm just like not that person. I mean, there's not a day that goes by where, you know, I don't get an email or a tweet that after being on TV saying, well, you know, you're chubby or you're this or you're that. But one of the things Ann Coulter told me is, you know, never repeat the awful things people say about you. And now I see on the conservative side, everybody wanting to use the negative things that the left says about them in order to say, look, I'm a victim, support me.
So where do you think is a victimhood, of course, is you know, it's I guess one of the longest lived, you know, stances that people take. And, you know, is that where does the fetishizing of victimhood come from in your estimation? And what might be done to, you know, and this isn't to say like, you know, just ignore actual outrages against people, but, you know, that first response of like, okay, I'm a victim. Love me, I'm a victim. How do you combat that, and how do you turn that around both on the right and the left? Because as you notice, we're in an outrage culture. Things are very polarized, and that, you know, what's happening is, as you know, people move further and further to the edges, they're also leaving more people behind. I don't, you know, I think fewer and fewer people probably see themselves as represented by Fox News or MSNBC. You know, how do we combat that kind of gesture towards being a victim and hence having something meaningful to say?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I'm stealing fetishizing victimhood, so look for that. I think part of it, if you look at, you know, what happened, like Twitter fights or, you know, social media fights, or, you know, some of the viral YouTube videos of, you know, the stunts, you know, whether they're on the right or the left, you can see that that's sort of its own, you know, niche market. And a good way to test this is think of like a Twitter fight that you've recently seen, and then, you know, at the next barbecue, you know, tell someone about this Twitter fight and have them look at you like you're crazy, explaining, you know, this big drama, and they have no idea what you're talking about. And, you know, to me, I mean, it's kind of similar to the 2016 election where people just didn't know that there's this swell of, you know, anti-Hillary sentiment. And I have to believe that if Twitter and that sort of stunt pulling politics is going to become niche, then there has to be this whole other world that is paying attention on a different level. And as far as, you know, stopping it, clearly, you know, if you want to send a message, you know, not that, you know, we want less stunts and more, you know, ideas and funny stuff, you have to buy the Social Justice Warrior Handbook. I mean,
that seems the clearest message. I mean, clearly step number one. and it might be the end of the, it's the only step you need. You know, needing 12 steps, that was always, you know, let's condense it to just one. Let's buy Lisa DePasquale's latest book, The Social Justice Warrior Handbook, a practical survival guide for snowflakes, millennials, and Generation Z. It's a very funny, very insightful, a kind of warm-hearted parody of, you know, that takes aim at outrage culture. Lisa, I want to thank you for talking to Reason.
Thank you.
All right. And this has been the Reason Podcast. And I was your host, Nick Gillespie. I hope to be again in the future. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.